Imagine stepping off a train today, August 9, 2026.
Right.
And if you're arriving in, say, Amsterdam or London, you don't even break your stride. You just seamlessly tap your phone against a turnstile to pay for your transit using systems like OVPay.
Exactly. It's entirely frictionless.
Yeah, the network just automatically calculates the cheapest fare in the background, the gates open, and you're on your way. But if you step off that exact same train in Berlin, you are greeted by something else entirely.
Oh, yeah, it's a completely different world.
It really is. You step into this, like, time capsule. Millions of euros are still being poured into maintaining these clunky, error-prone coin validators on ticket machines.
And bill acceptors that spit your money back out at you.
Right. And why? Because there is this deep-seated collective fear of total digital surveillance. People are literally fighting to keep loose change as a bastion of personal freedom.
It serves as a perfect tangible symbol for the moment we find ourselves in right now, doesn't
It
it?
really does.
I mean, we are expending massive amounts of energy and capital to preserve a very fragile analog status quo, all while this technological tsunami is just building up all around us.
And that tension is exactly what we are exploring in today's deep dive. We're unpacking a highly provocative new article by a Dutch innovator named Rog van Linde.
It's called The Fall of the Wall of Illusion.
Yes, and his core argument is that Europe's highly moralistic approach to digital privacy is just crashing spectacularly against the reality of global tech dominance.
It's a really bold piece.
It is. And look, as we dive into this piece today, we're going to hit some serious third rails. We are talking about EU tech regulations, US corporate dominance, and severe labor exploitation in the global South.
Heavy topics for sure.
Very heavy. So I want to be super clear right up front. Our job today isn't to take a side or endorse the author's specific viewpoints. We are just acting as impartial guides here.
Right, we're just laying out his arguments to see why he thinks this approach is heading for a wall.
Exactly. So I'm so glad to have our expert here with us to help decipher how these individual privacy fears are maybe blinding us to massive global shifts.
Thanks for having me. Bringing this to light is vital because this isn't just, an abstract debate about data privacy laws.
No, not at all.
It's fundamentally about the infrastructural architecture of the 21st century. It determines who gets to control the underlying plumbing of our modern world.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the author starts by pointing out how this technological denial plays out in our daily lives, and he calls the European approach to data protection schizophrenic.
Which is a strong word, but his example is incredibly vivid.
It really is. He points out how citizens will aggressively fight against digital prescriptions at the doctor's office. They insist on paper forms, arguing that their medical data has to be kept completely offline.
Right, to prevent a single error or leak.
Yeah, but then that exact same citizen will sit on the toilet happily scrolling on their smartphone, right? Allowing Google to serve them hyper-targeted ads for 3-ply chamomile-scented luxury toilet paper.
That contradiction is the absolute heart of the privacy paradox. Because when that person is scrolling on the toilet, the smartphone isn't just randomly guessing they might want toilet paper.
Right, it's not a coincidence.
No, it is transmitting their precise geolocation, their dwell time, meaning how many milliseconds they lingered on a previous post, their age demographics, and their recent search queries.
Just a massive amount of data.
Exactly. And all of that is beamed in real time to servers thousands of miles away in Silicon Valley, processed through predictive algorithms, and returned as an ad.
It's like putting three heavy deadbolts on your front door to feel perfectly safe from intruders while completely ignoring the fact that the entire back wall of your house is made of transparent glass.
That's a great way to visualize it.
But it makes me wonder, are we just protecting the wrong things from the wrong actors?
What's fascinating here is the illusion of control. We expend all this bureaucratic energy preserving a paper-based status quo because it gives us something tangible to hold on to.
Like holding a physical paper makes us feel secure.
Exactly. Filling out a physical form feels like a defense of our freedom. But the author argues this is a total illusion. Global algorithms are already predicting and, in many ways, controlling human behavior behind the scenes.
So we are guarding the analog front door while the digital back wall is completely wide open.
Yes. And moving from the individual citizen to the enterprise level, the author scales this exact same problem up to sovereign businesses and governments.
Oh, right. Because we always hear this very reassuring marketing phrase from tech companies operating in Europe. They say, "Don't worry, your data is securely stored in the Frankfurt am Main data center."
Ah, the infamous walled garden defense. We are led to believe that geographic location equals legal protection.
But Van Linde argues that phrase is nothing more than a legal placebo.
He does.
Wait, I need to challenge that, though. If the physical server is literally sitting in a building in Germany, shouldn't German or European privacy laws like the GDPR protect it? How can that just be a placebo?
To understand why it fails, you really have to look at the mechanics of the United States Cloud Act, the Clarifying Lawful Overseas Use of Data Act.
Okay, what does that do?
This law fundamentally alters the reality of data sovereignty by using extraterritorial jurisdiction. The Cloud Act legally compels U.S. tech giants, so Microsoft, Google, AWS, Apple, to grant U.S. authorities access to stored data via subpoena.
Wait, regardless of where the server is?
Exactly. The critical mechanism here is that the subpoena targets the corporate entity, not the physical hard drive.
So the U.S. government goes to Microsoft in Washington State and says, hand over this data. And it doesn't matter if Microsoft has to pull that data from a server in Seattle or a server in Frankfurt.
That is the exact mechanism.
All right.
The fact that the server is physically sitting in Frankfurt provides absolutely zero legal protection from U.S. access.
Because the company operating it falls under U.S. jurisdiction.
Right. And this creates a massive double standard in the market. Domestic European solutions are being crushed under the weight of massive GDPR requirements.
Oh, which mandate those incredibly strict, costly audits of how every single byte of data is handled.
Exactly. Meanwhile, schools, police departments, and huge multinational companies in Europe are all relying on Microsoft 365, Google Cloud, and AWS.
So they just accept the backdoor risks of the Cloud Act because Europe simply hasn't developed viable, scalable alternatives of its own.
Yes, which brings us to the really tragic case study in the source material, DeepL.
Most of you listening probably know DeepL. It's this brilliant Cologne-based language model that famously outperformed Google Translate in blind tests.
It was the absolute showpiece of the European tech scene.
Yeah, and its massive selling point for years was that it was made in Germany, hosted on European servers, fully GDPR compliant, and completely safe from U.S. access.
DeepL proved that linguistic nuance and world-class algorithmic precision didn't have to come exclusively from the U.S.
But then what happened?
To survive the demands of the modern internet, they had to capitulate. They eventually outsourced their server infrastructure to Amazon Web Services.
Wait, so even if a European company successfully builds a world-class AI, they are forced to hand over the keys because they literally don't have the plumbing to run it.
That's essentially it, yeah.
But why couldn't they just use a European provider? Aren't there big hosting companies in Europe like Hetzner or OVH?
There are, and those are solid, reliable companies for standard web hosting. But they are not hyperscalers.
Okay, meaning what?
AI requires a fundamentally different architecture. To process the sheer volume of global translation requests every single second, DeepL needed massive, globally distributed clusters of specialized GPUs.
So standard servers just wouldn't cut it?
No. They needed ultra-low latency data fabrics and massive caching layers. European providers simply cannot provide that raw, elastic compute power on a global scale.
Oh, wow. So as the author points out, Europe develops the brightest minds and the most elegant algorithms, but tragically leaves the scaling and the monetization to Seattle and Mountain View.
It's a huge structural failure.
Well, if Europe doesn't even have the foundational infrastructure for current technology, how is it possibly preparing for the future wave of AI?
Judging by the source material, the answer is dreadfully.
Yeah, there is a really chilling quote in there from the CEO of the infrastructure giant Cloudflare. He recently noted that human data traffic on the web will soon be a mere rounding error.
It's hard to wrap your head around, but we are reaching a historic tipping point. The internet is shifting from a place made by people for people to a high-speed highway built for machines.
So we're entering an era where autonomous AI agents use APIs to negotiate contracts, purchase server space, and direct massive data streams.
Yes, and they do it with other AI agents in milliseconds. Human input in that ecosystem becomes statistically insignificant.
And the contrast in how different regions of the world are reacting to this shift is staggering. The U.S. is currently building initiatives like Project Mecca.
Oh, those gigantic AI data centers.
Yeah, they are so massive they require their own mini nuclear reactors, known as small modular reactors, just to power the cooling systems.
It's an unimaginable scale.
And meanwhile, in the Middle East and Asia, countries like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan are forging very pragmatic military and arms tech alliances to share AI drone technology.
Right. They're preparing for the reality of the tech.
But what is Europe doing? The author highlights that European politicians are stuck in endless moral debates about enforcing chat controls on cell phones and putting digital watermarks on AI-generated images.
And the author warns that this approach is deeply dangerous. Forcing an EU-only infrastructure without actually having the necessary hyperscalers to support it creates a mandated economy of scarcity.
So what does this all mean? To me, it sounds like Europe is fiercely debating the font size on a stop sign while the rest of the world is busy building flying cars.
That's a brilliant analogy.
But I want to play devil's advocate here for a second. Isn't the EU right to try and regulate this?
Well, the intent behind the regulation is undeniably noble, sure.
Right, because given how powerful AI is becoming, someone has to put guardrails in place to protect citizens from rogue data collection or algorithmic bias.
Of course. But Van Linde's argument is about mechanics and leverage. You cannot successfully regulate an infrastructure that you do not own or control.
So the rules don't mean anything if you don't own the plumbing.
Exactly. By focusing entirely on bureaucratic compliance instead of technological innovation, this ideological zeal just punishes the local market. It results in higher prices, poorer performance, and total technological backwardness.
Like you said, you can write all the rules you want about how a flying car should operate, but if you don't know how to build an engine, you are just regulating thin air.
Precisely.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting, but also quite dark. While we marvel at these colossal AI projects in the US and these nuclear-powered data centers, the author peels back the glossy veneer of these Silicon Valley utopias.
He really takes us deep into the engine room.
He does. Because we have this pervasive hype around autonomous systems. Everyone talks about Tesla's full self-driving software or those Optimus humanoid robots as if they are pure machine-driven miracles of self-optimization.
But the reality is that the foundation of modern AI is built on intense manual human labor.
It is the dirty secret of the AI boom, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Before an algorithm knows how to identify a security threat, a harmful image, or hate speech, human beings have to manually teach it what those things look like.
And the author refers to them as the invisible factory workers of the internet age. We are talking about millions of click workers, data labelers, and content moderators.
Primarily located in the global south. Places like Kenya, Colombia, and the Philippines.
And for often less than $2 an hour, they sit in stark rooms manually filtering the most gruesome content imaginable.
They are drawing digital bounding boxes around weapons and videos, and they read through horrific text prompts to classify abuse and violence.
It's awful. They sift through the darkest parts of human nature piece by piece to keep the algorithms of OpenAI, Meta, and TikTok clean for Western consumers.
Exactly. And while big tech celebrates trillion-dollar valuations and record profits, these workers bear the psychological cost.
Left entirely mentally broken.
Yes. They are operating in digital sweatshops without trauma therapy, occupational safety standards, or fair wages. They are essentially absorbing the trauma so the algorithm can learn the pattern.
It completely shattered my whole perception of the technology. AI isn't some magical self-learning brain floating in the ether.
Not at all.
It is literally built on a foundation of digital day labor and piecework exploitation.
Which raises an important question, one the author explores deeply. Why is there no massive public resistance forming against this global imbalance?
Yeah, if the system relies on this level of exploitation abroad and simultaneously erodes our digital sovereignty at home, why are citizens collectively looking the other way?
Van Linde gives a very classical Roman answer for that. Panem et circenses. Bread and circuses.
Right. He argues that the system provides its own anesthetic to keep us docile.
Algorithmic numbing is a very real, measurable phenomena. Platforms like TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube Reels aren't just serving up entertaining videos.
They are deploying millisecond-level psychological interventions. But how does that actually work mechanically? Like, how does a video app numb someone to global infrastructural shifts?
It all comes down to the feedback loop. The algorithms analyze your pupil movement if you're on a compatible device, your scroll speed, and exactly how many fractions of a second you dwell on a specific frame of a video.
That is so invasive.
It is. They use this biometric data to map your preferences perfectly. Then they constantly feed your brain highly tailored content that triggers a dopamine release.
So they know what makes us tick better than we do.
Yes. Yeah. They learn the exact moment you're about to get bored or anxious, and they inject a new stimulus to keep you swiping. It essentially hijacks the brain's reward system.
And it just washes away any critical dissonance instantly. While people are trapped in this endless loop of hyper-entertainment or conversely, hyper-outrage and rage bait, they completely lose sight of the tectonic shifts happening in global power.
The anger isn't directed at the architects of this technological dependence. It gets vented in these endlessly staged culture wars about trivial things.
So it causes collective immobilization. The public is thoroughly distracted, the actual physical infrastructure is completely outsourced, and the human cost is hidden in the global south.
Which naturally leads us to the endgame. Where is this technological tsunami actually taking us if we don't change course?
Yeah, the author lays out an ultimate, fast-approaching dystopia, and he calls it the agentic swarm.
This refers to a near-future scenario where the Earth is covered by a densely interwoven layer of autonomous AI agents.
And to clarify, an AI agent isn't just a chatbot that answers questions, right?
Right. It is a program given a specific goal like optimize the supply chain or maximize energy grid efficiency.
Okay, so it has a job to do.
Yes. And it is given the digital tools, the API access, and the financial control to execute that goal on its own.
Oh, wow. So the swarm is what happens when millions of these agents interact, managing automated factories, financial markets, and military drone fleets at the speed of light.
Exactly. And in that system, human beings essentially become a hindrance.
A bottleneck.
Because the interaction speed of these algorithms exceeds human biology by a factor of millions. We aren't even asked for permission anymore.
Right. If a weather event disrupts a shipping route, the swarm reroutes ships, adjusts factory output, and alters market prices globally before a human manager has even poured their morning coffee.
The decisions are finalized before a human brain can even process the stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
We face a complete loss of control.
Humans are reduced from shapers of the system to mere bystanders. We'd be living inside an infrastructure that we do not fully understand.
And more importantly, it becomes an infrastructure that we cannot simply shut down in an emergency, because our very survival, our food, our power, our economy depends on it running continuously.
It's terrifying. So if we are stuck between this romantic, idealistic, shock-induced paralysis in Europe on one side and this incoming agentic swarm on the other, how do we survive it?
The author introduces a deeply pragmatic solution rooted in his own Dutch culture. He brings up two concepts.
Right, Koopmansgeest and Gedugen.
Yes. Koopmansgeest translates to the merchant spirit, and Gedugen is the pragmatic adaptation of rigid rules to practical reality.
It's a philosophy born directly of geography, isn't it?
It is. The Netherlands exists largely below sea level. Historically, when the seawalls threaten to give way, you don't have the luxury of sitting around having principled moral debates about the environmental impact of the sandbags.
Or the regulatory compliance of the water pumps.
Exactly. You build the system that holds the water back now.
It's pure survival instinct. You don't refuse a life raft just because it wasn't manufactured in your hometown or because the company that made it doesn't align with your data policies.
Right. Adapting to reality using Gedugen doesn't mean you condone all the flaws of the system.
Right. So he isn't saying we should applaud the data vacuuming of the Cloud Act or the labor exploitation of click workers.
No, not at all. He is saying that you cannot enforce your moral standards if you are completely dependent on someone else's infrastructure.
You have to have leverage.
Exactly. It means using the absolute best tools available globally right now to secure your own independence, your efficiency, and your freedom of action. It's a call for radical pragmatism.
It sounds like he wants Europe to tear down its digital paper fortresses and engage with the world exactly as it actually functions, rather than how lawmakers wish it functioned.
Because clinging to a non-existent ideal while the rest of the world builds the future might be the most dangerous strategy of all. You have to survive the flood before you can legislate the water.
That is perfectly said. To briefly recap our journey today, we started with the everyday illusion of local data privacy, the absurdity of clinging to coins in Berlin while our smartphones broadcast our intimate lives to Silicon Valley.
Such a stark contrast.
We explored the mechanics of the US Cloud Act, revealing how the phrase data stored in Frankfurt is a legal placebo.
And how it forced a European beacon like DeepBell to outsource their infrastructure just to access global hyperscalers.
Right. We contrasted the massive nuclear-powered AI projects happening globally with Europe's bureaucratic moralizing.
And we look into the dark engine room of AI built on the trauma of underpaid click workers in the global south.
All the while we're kept sedated by algorithmic dopamine loops on our phones. And finally, we explored the necessity of radical Dutch pragmatism to survive the coming agentic swarm.
Understanding these layers is the first step toward regaining actual control rather than just the illusion of it.
I completely agree. So, to leave you, our listener, with a final thought to mull over today as you go about your routine, I want you to look around at the smart devices surrounding you right now.
Oh, that's a good exercise.
Your phone, your watch, your smart speaker. Building on Van Linde's warning about the sheer speed of these AI swarms, consider this. How many micro decisions about what news you read today, about what products you buy this week, and fundamentally about what you believe to be true are already being made for you?
Completely invisibly.
Yeah. Milliseconds before your human brain even realizes you had a choice. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
It's been great.
Next time you tap your phone to get on a train or buy a ticket with a handful of coins, remember to keep questioning the reality behind the illusions. See you next time.